Hey, everybody. This is the Variety and iHeart podcast, The Big Ticket. I'm Mark Malkin. Today, I'm talking to Emma Corrin, the breakout star of season 4 of The Crown, for her work as Princess Diana. Even though most observers say she has an uncanny resemblance to the late People's Princess, Corrin says she just doesn't see it. She also talks about her newfound fame occurring while the world has been in lockdown due to COVID-19. Then later, Gina Torres. The actor talks about her new role opposite Rob Lowe on 911 Lone Star, what she thinks of the fourth Matrix movie, and where she keeps the much-talked-about dress she wore to Meghan Markle and Prince Harry's wedding. So stick around. We'll be right back. Welcome back to The Big Ticket. By now, most of you have heard of Emma Corrin. The 25-year-old Brit became a household name overnight for her work as Princess Diana on the fourth season of Netflix's The Crown. While her newfound fame has been extraordinary, Corrin hasn't had to cope with an overbearing spotlight because the fourth season premiered during the pandemic. I caught up with her over Zoom from her London apartment that she still shares with some friends. How are you? How are you holding up in this crazy life that you have now where everyone's talking about you, but we're all in lockdown?
Surreal. It kind of feels like something very, very big has happened, but I can't quite understand what it is because I'm experiencing it from the confines of my flat. So yeah, it's quite surreal.
Did you ever, in your wildest imaginations, ever think, one, you'd be playing a princess, two, you'd be playing Princess Diana?
No. I remember being on holiday with my family about years ago, maybe, when The Crown, maybe the second season had come out or something. And I remember them joking about who was going to play Princess Diana. I think one of my brothers was like, oh, Em, you should play Princess Diana. And I remember saying, like, you know, I was at university at that time. I was like in my wildest dreams. Very strange to think back on those kind of moments now.
So what does your brother say now?
I haven't actually reminded him of that conversation. I should do. Yeah.
You know, your mom was always told she looked like Princess Diana. You were told you looked like Jodie Foster. So when it came down to it, did your family and friends say, well, of course then?
Yeah, I think my friends thought it was really funny because, yeah, it had been a kind of running anecdote that my mom, when she was younger, looked a lot like her. But I'd never got that myself. I think, yeah, a lot of people have said Jodie Foster, which is weird.
Do you see it now, though, when you either look at the show or just look at you? Oh, yeah, maybe I do look like her a little bit.
Or
is that weird?
I kind of lost all conception of what I look like or she looks like. Honestly, it's so strange. I have no idea. It's one of those things that I just think you can't see yourself. Yeah.
So what is the wildest thing that's happened? I mean, I just have to go back to the fact that the world is so weird right now. We've all watched it. So what's like the oddest thing that's happened to you? Because it's not like you're walking down the street that often where people are going to say, oh my God, that's you.
Yeah, I guess it's nothing really, because I've been in my flat pretty much because we've been in lockdown. So yeah, I've been on a few walks around where I live and people have been like, oh my God. I think the funniest thing that happened was that my dog got recognized, not me. I think I was in Hampstead Heath, near where I live, and I passed these two girls, and one of them said, oh my God, isn't that Spencer? And that was my dog's name. And I just thought, what world are we living in? So funny. It was really funny.
Is there something sort of, you know, what's the word I'm looking for? Sort of comforting to know that the fact that this is all happening at the same time, you don't have to be thrust into that crazy spotlight right now. You have time to sort of compute it, if that makes sense.
Yeah, I've been reflecting on this a lot because I was initially so sad that we weren't going to do a press tour and we weren't able to have a premiere or celebrate together as a cast, because I think that's part of, even though promo can sometimes be quite tiring, I think it's a lovely moment where you get to celebrate what you've made together with your castmates. And it was very sad. I mean, I've seen Josh and Helena a couple of times, but like, apart from that, I haven't really seen anyone since March, that when we stopped filming. But actually, on reflection, I think it has kind of been, there is a silver lining, because it means that the, obviously, yeah, things have gone a bit crazy and suddenly a lot of people know who I am and have watched the show, but I haven't, I've kind of been protected from it in a way, because I've been inside just with my friends who are amazing and keeping me grounded and that kind of thing. But also for me, what will always be the most important thing in anything I do is the work. And I think, although I love events and parties and traveling and that kind of thing, doing press from my room in my flat and just talking about the work without going anywhere and like having all the glitzy bits means it's been very focused on the craft. And I think that that's a lovely thing. And that's how my friend put it, which was, I think, a very lovely thing to say.
Was there ever a time when you were on set and you're in one of the iconic outfits, wardrobe, and you said, you know what, let me go to Starbucks right now. Let's see what would happen if you walked into Starbucks.
I honestly don't know. I remember like we filmed in some central London locations where it was quite funny because I'd have to walk down like a street. I think it was when we were filming the bits outside the primary school, and it was really funny to see people think, what? But actually, I think if you take me out of context, people wouldn't have put two and two together.
I think they would. I think they thought they'd be seeing a ghost. What would happen?
Double take, I experienced quite a lot. Especially from like supporting actors who I think were there, obviously knew what the show was and what they were doing, but hadn't necessarily seen us before, in costume at least. And so it was quite funny when suddenly you come on set and everyone's like, oh my God, it's very sweet.
Tell me about the first time that you did look in the mirror. You're in one of the iconic outfits. Was it surreal? Was it, oh, I'm just wearing a costume? How did it feel?
For me, costumes and the wigs and the makeup are always like the cherry on top of everything that comes together. I kind of describe it as if you're wearing one of those morph suits that zips up to the very top. And it's kind of like all those elements are kind of like the final zip when you seal it all together. And all the rest of the work is all on the inside. And so it really is exactly as you say, like I would be in my trailer and, you know, your outfit would be hanging up and I'd get out of my like pajamas or whatever I was wearing in makeup. And suddenly, yeah, it does. It really helps you get a sense of her at that time. And also because I was playing her over such a long period of time, and actually so much of her clothing dictated the period that we were focusing on. I mean, how she, like those yellow dungarees she wears when she meets Charles for the second time, you know, that puts you in a very different place within her than, you know, one of the power suits later on in the series.
When you were reading the scripts, were you Emma, did you ever cry? Did you ever get very emotional?
Yeah, I did. I got very emotional, I think at 3 points. I got very emotional reading about when she left her flat, actually filming the scene where she's walking down the stairs and her flatmates are at the top of the staircase and they're saying, "Me right." And she's like, "Don't be silly, I'll see you soon." And you know that really she's never going to be able to be with them in the same way. And I live with friends from university that I've known for 5-6 years now. And I felt incredibly emotional at the thought of being snatched from, you know, your friends, the place where you feel comfortable and the place where you feel loved and secure, and catapulted into this very cold world, cold new world. I cried then. And also I found, Josh and I know both found the bits when they were happy in episode 6 very tender and very raw, because we had to focus a lot throughout the filming that we didn't play the ending and play the tragedy. And it was very hard to play those moments of happiness knowing it was coming. But when we did, it was very kind of beautiful, because I think he had an interviewer a few months ago say, "Oh my gosh, for those few moments, I totally forgot what happened. how it ended. And I just thought, oh my God, they're going to make it work. And it's like the saddest thing. You realize that like they were so great when they were great. And there was a lot of things that came into play that made it very complicated. Yeah.
So let's talk about your first day going to set or going to shoot or going to rehearse. Did you look at your flatmates and say, I'll see you soon?
Yeah. Bye, guys. I'm going to be a very different person when I come back from this. I remember, I think it was the read-through. We had a read-through, and I remember being picked up in a car, and I think I took my dog to the read-through, which was very funny. And I remember feeling this incredible trepidation. And I remember walking in, and there was like this long, long table with everyone's name cards, and I'd got that really early. And I just remember walking in, and it was me, and the name card on my left said Gillian Anderson, on my right to Josh O'Connor. Then opposite me was Olivia Colman and Helena Bonham. And I was just like, I think I must have a picture on my phone of the table because my mind was just blown. I was like, this is absolutely terrifying, but at the same time, incredible. And I think I owe that cast a great deal because it could have been the most terrifying, overwhelming experience. And at times it definitely was, but it is the happiest job. A lot of people say this. I know Olivia says this a lot, but it is genuinely the happiest job. And everyone is so warm that I really wasn't given a second, a chance to feel out of place it was wonderful.
If you ran into Prince Harry or Prince William on the street, what would you say?
It would be very hard to know what to say because just because I've played this character, it doesn't mean I have any understanding of what, you know, Diana was like at all. So although I would want to say like she was incredible and I understand, I also have no authority to say that at all. I've brought to life Peter Morgan's character. I think, to be honest, if I passed them on the street, I'd probably be so conflicted about what to say. They'd probably be long gone before I actually decided what to say. I can imagine like clutching their hand and looking into their eyes and searching for the words and not being able to quite communicate it. I think there would be too much to say. But I feel for them greatly.
If you were able to ask Diana a question, what did you really want to ask her? Is there that one question that sort of would help you with the role or just to understand her more?
That's such a good question. I guess one of the ones that immediately comes into my head was like, would be sort of, what made you fight in that moment where you decide that you want to take back control of the narrative, I suppose. What made that decision for you? What changed? Because I think we see that at the end of the series, it's sort of where we leave her, that look of simultaneous defiance and complete like sadness at the end as the series finishes. And I think that was always spoken of about as like that, this moment where she decides that she's done and she has to fight for herself now. And I don't know if that was actually a moment that she experienced, but I think I'd be really interested to find out when she stopped fighting for them and stopped fighting to fit in and decided to fight for herself, I suppose.
What did you think when you heard her brother and members of the government saying that there should be a warning on the series saying that this is a work of fiction?
It's difficult. I think that I don't think it should be necessary. I think it is very clearly a dramatized version of events. I mean, yeah, this is fictitious. It is just fictitious in the same way as, you know, people don't mistake Succession for what actually happened with the Murdochs, or like they don't confuse, you know, there are so many things that are dramatized the whole time. And I feel like as a population, we are aware of that to a great extent. I think it just comes, but I also understand that it comes from a place of sensitivity and protectiveness of the royal family here and of Diana. So I understand it. I just think that I guess from our point of view as the cast or the creators, and from the point of view of creators, it's so obviously fictitious because all of the work we do goes into creating this world. We're never doing impressions, we're never doing mimicry. You know, the facts are there. Like, they went to Australia, they had a son called William, they you know, went to this lunch or this party, but everything that fills those scenes, the substance of everything that we create is fictitious.
Did you take anything home from set?
I have, there was one day that we were set up in her bedroom and they had a load of like costume jewelry on the side. And I took a necklace. I took a gold chain and I was just like, I'm going to keep this because I need to take something as a memory. I've said this quite a lot and I'm still waiting for the call from Netflix to be like, can we have our chain back, please?
You know what? If they do that, you need to call me and we need to call them out on it. If they ask for that back.
You know what, though? I remember quite early on, I think I'd been at the studio for some fittings. I remember someone coming to me and being like, Emma, after this, you know, you're popping down to the prop department, the art department, and they've got like a setup they want to show you. And I was like, what? And I remember going along and being ushered into this like huge warehouse room. And they'd constructed this table, which was essentially meant to be Diana's table, with complete replicas of everything that, because I think she was pictured quite a lot in like portraits, I suppose, when you have like your role picture taken or whatever, sitting next to a table, which would have been her dresser maybe or something. And so they'd managed to find a lot of different bits and pieces that were actually the actual replica of what she had on her table. For instance, apparently she had loads of frog statues. She was obsessed with frog statues, which me and Ben Karen loved because of the whole like prince, princess, fairy tale right. element to everything. But also her perfume, which was from Penhaligon's. I actually have a bottle here. I have her perfume, which is quite creepy about it. And things like that, like the exact hairbrush she used or the little like, I don't know, pots and lotions and potions. It was terrifying. I remember walking in and being like, oh my God, this is so creepy. And I remember them saying, do you want to smell her perfume? And me thinking, I don't know if I do. I really don't know if I do. Because I'm a very smell oriented person. Mm-hmm. I remember thinking this could be so overwhelming for me. I don't know if I want to know what she smelled like, but yeah, it was so mad. The Crown are just incredible.
So did you ever spray that perfume?
What? I did have a bottle of it. It's sitting in the back of my cupboard because I got invited by Penhaligon's to go and try some of their perfumes, and whilst picking out mine they said, oh, did you know? And I was like, what? And they were like, well, did you know that this is where Diana got her perfume? And I was like, oh my God, no, I didn't know it was you. And they said, well, we'd love to give you a bottle of her perfume. And I thought, that's so nice. Also, I don't know what I'm going to do with it.
Right.
Bluebell something. And it's in the back of my cupboard and I don't really know what to do with it.
You've never sprayed it. You've never put it on.
Never. I can't. It's too much. Smell is too personal to me.
Well, Emma, thank you so much for chatting with me. This was wonderful. I'm so glad I got to meet you.
Likewise. Hopefully in person one day.
That was Emma Corrin. We're going to take a short break, but when we return, I catch up with Gina Torres to chat about her new work on 911 Lone Star, the fourth Matrix movie, and her Suits co-star Meghan Markle. Welcome back to The Big Ticket. Gina Torres has been acting for close to 30 years. She's most known for her work as Jessica Pearson on Suits. She's also appeared in the Matrix franchise. Now at age 51, she joins the cast of Fox's 911 Lone Star opposite Rob Lowe. We chatted from her home in Los Angeles. Did you know about 911 beforehand? Did you know about Lone Star beforehand? Or did you have to become familiar with it once you sort of got into it?
Well, I did. I live in LA, so there, you know, the University of Billboard certainly educated me on what's on TV. Not that I had time to watch any of it, but sure, you know, driving down and go, oh, Angela Bassett, good for her. Yeah, oh, Peter Krause, I love him, because I had just done The Catch. And I was like, ooh, that looks good. Okay. Sort of move on. And then, because I was doing Pearson when 911 launched, and then I wasn't anymore. and I guess Tim Minear says I was busy when Lone Star, you know, came along. Right. I believe him. And really, true story, quite by accident, I was home and the TV was on, and it just happened to, I mean, I'm sure I clicked over from streaming something and it just like was on, and I'm like, who are these people? What's this storyline? Oh my God. I mean, look at all these gorgeous, young, diverse, like characters, and that's so interesting. And then I left the room and Rob Lowe's on, and like, did somebody change the channel? Oh, no, wait, it's the same show. and not in a bad way. It was just like, right. I'm trying to make sense of the world that I'm watching. And so I just sat down, and I must have left the room when the 911, you know, what's the emergency thing came on. Because then finally I'm sitting there and that happened. And I thought, holy, no way.
Yeah.
Okay. All right, Fox, I see you.
It's pretty amazing when you really look at not only the cast, but then the storylines.
Yeah.
Where it's just, you know, I know we were just talking about our ages, but could you ever have imagined something like that when we were growing up?
No.
Maybe a little Archie Bunker, but did we even understand exactly what Norman Lear was doing? Probably not, you know? And you look at this and it blows my mind.
Yeah,
100%. That a procedural.
No, you're absolutely, and you're 100% right, because I consumed television when I was a kid.
Yeah, me too.
And so when you bring up Norman Lear, when you bring up the stuff that even Happy Days to some degree, like it was 7 years of coming of age stories, right. You know, in this way. And it was so, and I honestly don't think I'm being nostalgic about it, because it wouldn't keep coming up if it wasn't really pushing the envelope and the storylines that he told back in the 70s, whether it was the Jeffersons or Good Times or Maude or, you know, all of those shows, even Mary Tyler Moore, which predates that by just a little bit. And then we kind of went into this safe place. And then we kind of went into this, dare I say it, stupid place.
I dare you to say it, you said it, you can say it.
It wasn't challenging anymore. And there were voices that kind of popped up like Roseanne was an example of that. But as a person of color, when we lost The Cosby Show, when we lost A Different World, when we lost Living Single, nothing replaced it. And so we took this huge step back, fighting for a voice, a consistent voice. And so to answer your original question, to now sort of move into this space where where the hunger is being addressed, where the necessity for these voices and these storylines is being acknowledged. It's such a privilege to be able to be a part of that.
Do you remember the first time you saw Rob Lowe? Like, how old were you? Because I will tell you specifically, he's one of the two reasons I know I'm gay.
And he is specifically one of the reasons why a lot of people know they're straight. or maybe not.
Yeah. I mean, I was a poster hanging in my best friend Heather's bedroom when I was in high school, and I would look at it. It was a black and white, and I'd look at it, and that's how I knew. Do you remember the first time when you, because I mean, that's our,
oh
I mean,
it's it's first of all, being up close to that, that doesn't disappoint.
I mean, he hasn't aged.
It's ridiculous. Yeah. It's ridiculous. It's like, I used to be the pretty one in the room. I just give that up. But of course, but you know, there's that double-edged sword, right? Just to dovetail back on what we were just talking about. So mm-hmm. he's such a huge part of my adolescence and my coming of age story, right? Just like all those John Hughes movies and all, you know, and the Rat Pack. And I recently did Riverdale. So I got to just like in passing, just like exchange a few words with Molly Ringwald. And she was every 16-year-old girl.
Yeah.
But she wasn't. And so my experience of that whole time was washing over me like everybody else, right? The phenomenon of all those movies, of all like St. Elmo's Fire. And I mean, the list goes on and on.
Right.
And it's not until, honestly, it's not until like recently where you acknowledge, well, I had to acknowledge the fact that I jumped into those worlds because I had no choice but to.
Right, that's all that there was.
I had to find an emotional connection because that was all that there was. An emotional connection to all of that anxiety, right? All that teenage angst, all the things that are universal about those shows. But did a boy ever pick me up in his car in the Bronx? No.
a boy never picked me up in his car in Queens, so
you know what I mean? I mean, there just were not universal experiences to be had in like at face value. There was no prom, there was, you know, just all of that was going on. And so it's so interesting to experience him now in my world.
So what is it like working with Rob Lowe?
He's lovely.
Yeah.
He's just, I mean, as you can imagine, has all kinds of stories, has worked with everybody, has been in the company of everybody, and God bless him and thank you. He loves telling those stories. So in between, I mean, you know, in between action and cut is a lot of fun too, but between like cut and action, that's where the money is.
What was it like walking on set for the first day? Obviously, because, you know, the show had been around for at least for a season. So what's it like sort of being the new gal in town, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. I was nervous. Mm. I was definitely, first of all, I hadn't worked in a while because of the COVID of it all.
Right.
And then our executive producer, head writer Tim Minear, is the reason why I'm there. You know, he created this part for me. And when that sort of starts making its rounds, like we're like, this is who I want and this is who we're getting and this is and that, it's just like you don't want to disappoint anybody. When you get there. So it's daunting and an incredible responsibility and a little nerve-wracking. But at the end of the day, you know, I just have to do what I do. And everyone was so welcoming. I mean, it really is. It's a great cast. It's a great, all those guys like Tosh and Jim and Julian and Ronan and Brian, they're just yummy. So absolutely yummy to work with.
Who is Tommy Vega? What could you tell me?
She is she's every woman. She really is. She's a pleasure to step into at this point in my career. She's the backstory is that she was at the top of her game. She was an absolute like paramedic, phenom, badass. Got married, got pregnant with twins, left her world behind her. Her husband's a restaurateur. And she was like, you know what? I'm going to raise these babies and you got this. and that's what they did for 8 years. And then COVID happened and he was forced to close his restaurant. And I had to go back to work. So before, you know, she's dealing with, again, like she's every woman, right? She's every woman out there. She's dealing with a career that she loved and was really good at and passionate about. But while she was doing all that, her babies didn't exist. Mm-hmm. And now she has another part of her heart that is all just, you know, involved and passionate about her family and her children and being a soccer mom and baking cookies and making all that happen. But she's torn and she's at home thinking about work and she's at work thinking about her babies. And how do you balance all of that? And I love playing that because I don't really have to play it. That's kind of my life. I understand that deeply. And I'd love to put a spotlight on that because none of that's easy at all. You know, my character previous to this had made a very specific choice about how she wanted to live her life and was unapologetic about that. And this is really the first time that I'm playing a woman who decided that she couldn't have it all because she couldn't be what she wanted to be.
Right.
And now life happened. And so she's kind of forced to figure out what that looks like.
So you mentioned your character's husband's restaurant closed because of COVID. So has COVID been brought in a big chunk of the storylines?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I really don't think they could have done the audience a service because as first responders, as frontline workers, you can't ignore what's happening around us. Mm. Like, we're not an alternate universe. We're a real-time universe. So we acknowledge it. There are a lot of masks on the set, in front of and behind, and of course, behind the camera. But I can assure the audience that you're not going to be treated to an hour of this. that's not what we're doing. The show that we're producing. That's not that. So you'll see our eyes, you'll see our faces, you'll see our whole faces. There's a full range of emotion.
I did want to ask you, obviously you have a history with Matrix. Could you believe there's another Matrix coming?
I thought first of all, not to be bitter or anything, but the people that are actually in the movie, I believe, died. And the people that aren't, didn't. Mm. So that's all I have to say about that.
But you know what? You're on Lone Star.
I am. I am indeed, and happily so.
Did you ever think though you'd see a Matrix 4 movie?
No, I really did. I'm so curious about where they're going with this and what's their jumping off point and what story they wanted to tell, quite frankly. Mm. Because it just felt like they told it. Yeah. I mean, am I wrong about that?
do you remember reading the scripts? Did you understand what was going on when you read the scripts?
You know, The Matrix scripts were really the beginning of creatives and writers not wanting to let anybody know what's going on. So although Keanu and Lawrence and Carrie Ann, you know, got full scripts, and people who were throughout the movie got, I got scenes.
Got it.
And like little bits and pieces. So, you know, I'm not in the first one. So I just remember Lawrence telling me about it and thinking, that's great. Sure. Good luck with that. And then I went to Sydney. I went to visit him on set in Sydney, and they had just cut together. I remember the Wachowskis had a dinner party because they wanted to show the cast what they had cut together. And what they had cut together was the rescue sequence, the beginning of the rescue sequence, and the very beginning. So it was Carrie Ann, right? It was Hugo, basically telling his men they're already dead.
Right.
Cut to Carrie Ann kicking Major butt, and then that whole like that bank sequence scene where they go to rescue Morpheus, and the first time you see bullet time. And the first time you see, and I'm sitting there, and I didn't even know my mouth was open. Like, I had no idea how far down my jaw had dropped. And then I don't think I had actually taken a breath for like 3 minutes. And I was like, oh, that's what y'all are doing all the way down here in Sydney.
Like, that's what you were talking about.
Oh, I don't think any of them could have possibly imagined.
So where is the dress you wore to the royal wedding? That dress. I mean, headlines around the world.
I just bought a little frock off of the internet.
Was it really?
Yes. Yes. That's all I did. I really didn't think it was, I was there were, I mean, come on, it was a royal wedding.
Right.
I'm pretty sure, you know, in the UK, there was absolutely no reason for me to think that I was going to get any camera time whatsoever. You know, I found had a really cute hat made that I loved, that I knew I could wear again. Right. I was going to pull that, you know, that little flower off of the side of it. And I was going to wear that little fedora all spring, all into the summer. I had no delusions whatsoever. And I remember a lot of the ladies and I who we all knew, you know, who we were friends with, were all on a thread. And there was this concern, right? Because of protocol and what's acceptable.
Right.
And, you know, none of this and none of that and none of this and none of that. And I got so irritated with, and a lot of it was funny that I can't even repeat, but I just remember thinking, well, my dress is some of that and some of that and some of that.
And we'll see what happens.
But no one's going to be looking at us because we're the ugly Americans. So who cares?
Don't sell yourself short.
So it's in my closet. I'm sure I will donate it at some point because there's no way in hell I could ever wear that thing again.
Right.
Which is a shame because I like it, but it was it was quite something. You know, we had to give up our phones, and when we all got back on our bus to be taken back to the hotel, and we were given our phones back, and the bus had sort of moved out of the dead zone, you could hear all the cell phones ringing in the block, like all of this cacophony of pings and right. all of these websites and people sending me this and that and pictures and that again, that 10 best dress, what? What? And my sister who lives in the UK, I guess by the time we got back, like that morning, all the newspapers and yeah. And so I kept as many clipping. I think just from newspaper weight alone coming back into the US, because it's like, I got to put this in a book somewhere. It was completely surreal. It was crazy.
I know everyone keeps trying to ask you, like, you're going to have a suits reunion and she's going to come back for it, right? You're going to have a suits reunion. She's going to come back for it.
Yeah, I keep waiting for that.
That's what I keep saying. Like, when they moved to the U.S., like, oh, she's going to act again. I'm like, why would that happen? You know, it's nice that she's, you know, narrating a documentary and it's going to go to a good cause, but I just don't see her stepping on. I'm not saying that she can, but I just can't see her just stepping on as Tommy Vega's new paramedic.
No. I can honestly say, of all the people that have come in and out of my life, I worry about her the least. In fact, not at all.
she's gonna be fine.
I think she's just fine.
Gina, thank you so much. This was so much fun.
Thank you.
Stay safe, be well, and hopefully when we do meet, we'll get to meet in person next time.
That would be great.
That was Gina Torres. The new season of 911 Lone Star premieres on Fox on January 18th. That's it for this episode of The Big Ticket. Thanks for listening. You can also find me in the pages of Variety and on Variety.com. And make sure to follow me on Twitter and Instagram at Mark Malkin. Until next time, stay safe and be well. And please keep wearing those masks. See you soon.